I'd like to welcome you to Scanners. This is the last talk in our series of events. Scanners is, and so there's a few things I'd like to say first. So this has been a month-long project devoted to highlighting the book as a physical object. And our last night is Sunday, so there's going to be a closing party with beer, if you want to come for that. And it'll be from 6 to 10. Free beer, yes. Beer you don't have to buy. And I also wanted to thank a few people who have been, there's been a lot of people who have helped us with this project as it's been going on. So I'd like to thank Chris Hoff for his help with the audio, Andrew Hoff, who both of the Hoffs are Nick's brothers, for his help with setting up the store, John Baruso, my brother, for helping with the graphic design, Maya Ip and Courtney Johnson for all of their help, Charlene Tan, who did all of our rails, building the rails, Margaret Tedesco, Mina Dresden Gallery, this is Mina Dresden's gallery, Gibbs Chapman for the nice screen that we use, Roland Neese for the microphones, Mary Ellen Johnson for the projector, all the stuff we have is totally borrowed, so Mary Ellen Johnson for the projector, and Linda Hoff for her help with the chairs. So now, thank you. Hopefully I didn't forget anybody. So now I want to just introduce the people who are going to speak tonight. The first is Daryl Alvarez. He is a visual artist and a writer. His work will soon be going up in the two SF MoMA exhibitions, The Air We Breathe, opening on November 4th, and 50 Years of Bay Area Art, the SECA Awards, opening on December 8th. Presently, he is working with the author Kevin Killian towards a video project that will premiere in 2012. And secondly, we have Coulter Jacobson. Coulter is an artist alive in San Francisco. He is working on a no-play opera with his band Coconut. He sometimes makes books as the Robot Publication Studio in Berkeley. And he, like Daryl, is participating in two upcoming shows at SF MoMA, The Air We Breathe and The SECA Show. So Daryl's going to speak first, and then Coulter will be second. Okay? Thanks.
So the title of this is Assisted Walking. A description for this evening said I'll be talking from a personal perspective about books in contemporary sculpture. And I hope that no one will be disappointed that the books and mostly the personal have expanded and nudged aside any mention of sculpture. So it's in fact embarrassing how first person singular this essay is. But anyway, preparing for this, I started the way I often start these days. When working on an idea, I started with an image in mind, and I Googled it. I was thinking about books and my early history with them. My mother, Ethel, she did her best to install a love of books in me through reading aloud and frequent trips to the public library and neighborhood bookstore. I like to joke now about her choice of materials. When I was young, she read Poe. The Raven was my favorite, and I loved to hear it again and again. As I grew older, she would share whatever she was reading herself, which were often Agatha Christie murder mysteries. They were more tea than blood, so not as inappropriate as they might sound. However, her taste did lean towards the morbid, and there was finally one book that I had to ask her to stop reading. We had gotten 3/4 of the way in when I was just too terrified to continue. I must have been about 9, and the book that scared me so much was The Exorcist. The possessed was a child, and it made me feel vulnerable, to put it lightly. I slept with my body pressed against the wall because I had some idea that any space between the architecture and myself was where the demons could slip in. And yet the fact that a book could scare me made me all the more fascinated with them. When I started my image search for tonight, the first goal was to get a shot of the Stockton Public Library. It's a beautiful modernist building that I was long drawn to, probably first for the way the ramps hedge around the water feature in the court. They're long ramps with a wheelchair-friendly gradual incline, and they have a type of M.C. Escher logic that made them great for games of tag with my younger brother, David. Later, I came to also appreciate the sanctuary, the library's books. That's the library. It was divided, as most libraries, into sections that cater to age levels, interest, and so in time I graduated from the lower levels of carpets and ferns to the airy glass and oak adult stacks with their soft-voiced librarians and high ceilings. The building itself was centered in the old downtown, sharing a plaza with the main auditorium, City Hall, which also had a police headquarters in the back, and Stockton's best Mexican restaurant. So I was surprised that not one photo of it came up in my web search. Fortunately, I knew that Stockton was documented in Street View in maps, so in fact, I could look at the building again and from multiple angles. One of the first things I noticed was the name. It is now the Cesar Chavez Library. This is gratifying on a very personal level, since Ethel had done a lot of volunteer work with the farm workers' movement. One of my most exciting childhood memories was meeting her hero, Cesar Chavez, at one of the marches she took me to. I remember the march as well. It was through one of the smaller farming communities, maybe Gilroy. Our police escort rode ahead of us on horseback, and I made it my job to make sure my mom didn't step on any of the road apples. The next thing I looked at was not the library itself, but its neighborhood. This was Street View, so I could virtually walk the streets of my old world center and see what had changed. First, I went round the corner, where I spent every Friday night, with my father, brother, and various neighbor kids, the YMCA. Fridays were family night. For one price, the whole family was admitted, and so my dad, Sharky Alvarez, would take all the neighbor kids who wanted to join, the Boscos, the Hernandezes, and my best friend Todd, who was African American. He'd put down his $5 and he'd say, "We're all family." On Street View, it shows that the Y is completely stripped of signage and that the first floor windows are boarded up, as is the entrance. For any of you familiar with the book or the film Fat City, this is where the two central boxers first meet while training. My father was a boxer back before I was born. He had also done some work in the fields, as did I one summer, as did the older of the two boxers in Fat City. In fact, this is a side note. One day, during my first month in Berlin, some new German friends took me to a German restaurant where they tried to translate the menu for me, and nobody knew the English word for Spargel. So someone drew a picture of it on a napkin. I looked, and once I figured out what the picture actually was, I said, asparagus. I once spent a summer harvesting asparagus. And the woman seated next to me said, "Well, now you can eat it." Two blocks south of the Y was San Joaquin Middle School. It was a Catholic school. I'd been doodling forever, but it was at this school that Sister Catherine, a very sweet and enthusiastic art teacher, planted the serious notion of pursuing my interest in drawing as something more than a hobby. It was also at this school that I got in trouble for taking on my mother's morbid taste in literature. I was reading Helter Skelter, a book about the infamous Manson family's two-day killing spree in 1969. And one of the older nuns was worried for my soul. Ethel was humble in front of the nuns, but alone she simply told me that there would be some books I'd have to enjoy at home. We weren't Catholic. That is, Ethel was Christian, but religion wasn't pressed on either my brother or myself. The reason I went to San Joaquin Middle School was because the public schools in Stockton had a reputation for violence. And with the girlish way I carried my books, I was already a bully magnet. I wasn't even 100% safe under the watchful eyes of the Brides of Christ. One day, a group of boys decided to throw me under a car. It was parked in the school playground. For a while, I just laid there looking at the underside of the vehicle, enjoying a moment of solitude as they ran to get to their next class. On Street View, the building is still there, and behind it is still the all-cement playground / parking lot. The name on the school is now James Urbani. This is news to me, but evidently old news. Just as there is a wedge of time between my memory of Stockton and the photos on Street View, so there is a wedge between when those photos were taken and now. The James Urbani Institute of Language Development, which might be a more politically correct way of saying ESL school, has moved to a larger location south. The school I went to might be empty now, but the convent that sat next to the school, fittingly, is a women's center. From here, I strolled back to the library to look around some more. Across the street from the library is a square with a public fountain, and next to the fountain is a war memorial with the name of Mom's nephew, who had been killed in Vietnam, amongst many other names. Like the Cesar Chavez Library, the square has been politicized and is now called Dr. Martin Luther King Plaza. On the other side of the square is the police station where Mom worked as a meter maid. Her best work buddy, Dee Dee Blank, when I borrowed the drag name Dee Dee, it was in honor of this very tough, plus-size woman with a body sense of humor and a collection of Siamese cat tchotchke. She brought my mom to the Port Stockton Motorcycle Club, where Ethel met Sharky. They were married at the dawn of the 60s, and there is photographic record of their courtship and early years together in one of the motorcycle club's photo albums, including a shot of my mom at a biker camp out pregnant with moi. Later, she became a librarian for an elementary school. It was there that she and the school principal together put together a video show that would run in the mornings before classes. He played himself, Principal Hustis, and she was Chubby the Clown, the friendly trickster who would inevitably pie him or let loose a bucket of water, snakes in a can, and so forth. The police station is now a fire station. From what I heard, the police had taken over part of the community college campus. The fountain in the square stopped working years ago. The civic auditorium that was also on the square is now called the Visitors Bureau. And the Mexican restaurant is actually 2 blocks away from where I had recalled it. Also, it's no longer any good, according to the Yelp reviews. It's all kind of the same, but different. A few blocks west of King Plaza on Flora Street is where my much older half-brother, Carl, lived, between wives. His place was a 70s bachelor pad, complete with glass coffee table, a Playboy bunny puzzle, and a waterbed. Across the street were a few members of the Manson family, members who had moved there after the trial. After finding the body of a family member, James Willett, in Guernsville, the police got a warrant to search the house and discovered his wife, Lauren Willett, under the building. She was buried in a crawl space. In many ways, Stockton is like a broken and smaller Los Angeles, so it made sense that the extra Mansonites drifted up there after the LA camp was busted. Squeaky lived in our town too, till the failed assassination attempt on Gerald Ford in Sacramento. From 2002 to 2007, I made a series of works about the Manson family, drawings, videos, little zines, and sculptures. These works had a public reading, which had to do with the history of California during the years leading up to the Tate-LaBianca murders, and then a second private reading, which was more about my own family and growing up in Stockton in the years after those murders. I liked the works having a coded message, like cryptograms, a style Poe played with in The Gold Bug, or even things like the things that people write on the back of photographs. In 1999, my friend Jennifer drove me to Stockton. I've never had a car or even a driver's license. We went for a funeral. Sharky and Ethel had died only a week apart. It's touching in retrospect. They loved each other so much that as soon as one became seriously ill, the other followed. The service was odd for many reasons I won't go into, but the highlight of it had to be when Dad's sister, Lupe, got up to speak. She was there, this tiny old Mexican woman recalling her childhood in Stockton, as I am doing today. And she told us how she was so proud of her brother when they were kids. He sold newspapers in front of the Stockton Hotel, and I would go to meet him after school. Sometimes he would let me hand the newspapers to the customer, but other times he was very busy and very professional. But the thing I look forward to most came at the end of the day. That was when he pumped me. Oh, how he pumped me. He pumped me all the way home on his bicycle. Jennifer and I revisited Stockton last year. We looked around. This is during a funeral, so we had to, like, not laugh. We looked around part of downtown, but not the library. The day was uncomfortably hot, and Stockton more depressing than I even remembered it. That year, it had been listed the second worst city in the U.S. based on crime, unemployment, and so forth. Detroit had beat it out. Even as a failure, Stockton could only nab second place. I went to the two homes of my childhood, one of which had recently burned down by a fire started by meth addicts. I walked around and peeked in the blackened rooms. There was the bedroom where Mom had read to me, and the wall, now scorched, that I had slept pressed against. My younger brother, David, who I'll be seeing here in San Francisco next week, told me about the fire beforehand, so I was mentally prepared and didn't feel that sentimental about it. Stockton itself was never nice. We heard gunfire almost every night, and twice while we lived at that address, stab victims had come to bleed on our porch and beg us to call an ambulance. I loved the library mostly because it offered a form of escape. As a teenager, I went there to check out all the works of Raymond Carver, who wrote about being drunk in Sacramento, Oakland, and Stockton. It's ironic that I could escape a town by reading about it, but in fact, that parallel made the escape all the more potent, since Carver had become so loved both by readers and writers who emulated him. He was a living example of escape. Once I was 18, I too opted for a more literal escape than a literary one. I moved to San Francisco, where the first place I stayed was with a friend who, whose dad ran the mortuary just further down Valencia. I stayed a few weeks with them in a small room between the coffin room and the embalming room. I fantasized about picking someone up just to see the look on his face when I'd brought him home. But I was still too shy and bookish then to figure out how to find a date. I got a job at a bookstore, the first of many bookstores, and made friends with the night manager, a girl of my age named Suzette. With her, I attended a reading by Raymond Carver at the old Arts Commission Gallery, the space that they had before the earthquake of 1989. Someone else read first. Actually, I remember. It was Anne Rice's husband. He was horrible. Anyway, during the break, between the readings, I was standing next to Carver in line for the toilet, and I got the nerve to start a conversation. I mentioned that I was from Stockton, and he recommended Fat City to me, which at that point I hadn't read yet. I loved the book and the John Huston film as well. And so I forced my students in my first class at SFAI to read it as well as to watch the film. Some of them, I think a couple of them said they were coming tonight. They can probably give you a less biased opinion of the work. My opinion, Susan Terrell is brilliant as the drunk Oma. Her performance feels like that weird harness of pride and failure that is extremely Stockton. It's a sort of embarrassed resolve to stay put in the midst of a hopeless situation. She was nominated for her performance up against Shelley Winters from The Poseidon Adventure. Both of them lost to Eileen Heckart from Butterflies Are Free. Later in life, Susan Terrell lost both her legs as a result of blood clots from a rare blood disease, though she continued to act in films. An old boyfriend of mine, who lives walking distance from here, saw her once in a restaurant with her prosthetics and crutches, and knowing I was a fan, he asked her for her autograph on the only paper he had with him, a paperback copy of The Gold Bug by Edgar Allan Poe. Okay, that last sentence, and only that last sentence about the autograph book, is actually fiction. I was looking for a poetic way to end this ramble, as I think it's something I like most about books, the way that even when there's not an ending, they always close, the good ones, on such a strong note. I'm sorry, I can't do quite the same.
Wow, that was awesome. So those were from Google, right?
Yeah, this is all Google's research.
Is that letting a secret out?
No. I think it was in the... Didn't I mention that?
Did you?
And you're down here now. Is that you?
Yeah. Thanks. So I was told that tonight we would hopefully cover... the idea of sources, or what our approach to sources is, and like the kind of nerd that I am, I go to the OED and instead of Google, and source. I mean, it's sort of obvious where it comes from, but I was surprised by aside from it just being in the water from the earth or a spring, that it's rise, and that made me think of this. The first piece I saw of Daryl's in New York City. It's a woman, one of the Black Panthers, with her arm up, and I still have that postcard. I took two, actually, and had them on my wall for a very long time, but I'm really happy to be reading with Daryl tonight, one of my favorite artists. And thank you, everyone, Nick and Matt, for inviting me. I'm going to start by reading this sort of weird, it's by William Everson, who I don't know much about. I just found this book the other day at Books and Bookshelves, and happened to be reading this one presentation he gave about books. He was a publisher, I guess, lived in Berkeley, San Francisco too, lived in a farm and maybe stocked, I don't know. No. Anyway, the book's called Earth Poetry. I think he's a pagan. So he says, I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about the book itself as a central archetype of our culture and history, because whatever you do with a book, you're working with it also as a symbol. It is the implication and consequences that inhere in the book as a symbol that makes both the incentive and also the terrible warp in your judgment as you approach it. There are very few perfect books. Very few perfect books have ever been written, and very few that are perfect have ever been printed. He has high standards. One reason for that is the pressure that inheres in the book as symbol. It is so great that the individual consciousness, when it approaches, it cannot embrace the book in its totality. The idea of the book, the concept of the book, and what we call the archetype of the book is so powerful that it has a way of reaching out and grabbing you and taking you into a dimension of itself. The distortion in yourself as you approach it, chiefly through your lack of experience with it, is bound to have its registration upon the book itself, upon your production of it, upon your poems as you write them, upon your critical values as you try to conceive and execute the perfect format. The archetype of the book works two ways. It is both conservative in the sense that it carries the sum of the past within it, but it also carries implications for the future. Because that is the way ideas are transmuted and possessed. It is this double range that is the awesome thing about it. I mean, the invincible thing about the book is its capacity to reach backwards and forward. In a sense, it's out of your hands before you get it and after you are finished with it. Whatever you do to it, it will remain spoiled in some way by your contribution to it. I like that part. So my presentation, I think, is going to be about how I spoil many things. But some small part of what you put into it might survive in an effective way. But the book generally goes on following the momentum of its own history. So I kind of went back through a lot of my work that I've done and tried to focus on book-related things that I've done kind of peripherally or specifically. And when I was going to the Art Institute, I didn't make very much art, but I wrote a lot then, and I wrote this one short story about a girl growing up and then going blind. And it's set in 1986 during the Christa McAuliffe, the Challenger explosion. And I thought of it sort of as an autobiography, even though I'm not a girl or blind. But anyway, this piece came much later, but I do these things called memory drawings. And where I draw kind of as best I can from either the photograph or the source, the book, and then do it a second time from memory, putting the other two things away. So this piece was just copied from a book called I Touch the Future. It's the it's the book about Christa McAuliffe. And let's see, next slide. How do you do that? Oh, I see. So here's the memory of it. It was done like 2 months later, so it really starts to kind of get distorted. And, of course, the text shortens. But you can't. And I realized that trying to retain memory through a visual thing is very different from text. Text, when you're trying to memorize something, you know, in terms of like a play or something, it's very different from trying to remember, you know, shapes next to other shapes. But so I grew up, I mean, that was kind of a big, one of the biggest memories that I have growing up, 1986. It was very defined because Christa McAuliffe was on TV like every, you know, the big lead up, and we watched it in school. So I was interested in like how that, as kind of a pop cultural thing, affected me as an individual and the nation and everything. But, oops. Okay, Daryl mentioned Agatha Christie, so this is the last page of a book by Agatha Christie called Elephants Can Remember. And it's a bad slide, I think. Yeah, it's horrible. This is my first PowerPoint, too. totally. So an interesting thing about this piece I found afterwards, I heard it was on NPR, it was some program about Elephants Can Remember was sort of this critical book change in I guess there was like this computer program that could read all like every book that an author's written, and it kind of like calculates what words are used, and it kind of surveys it and whatnot. And this book, for some reason, all like words started to shift. It's like this critical kind of change in Agatha Christie's oeuvre. It was like her 40-something book, but it was probably a sign of whatever she had. Dementia or whatever, but like she started using the word something and or some words like that. There's a name for those kind of words. I forget. Anyway, it's okay. And this is the pages from the book of Carell. Basically, what I did is the book by Jean Genet. I'd drew on each page, open the pages, and just kind of use both hands at the same time, and did a drawing of two sailors, sort of like a mirror image, sometimes blind contour drawing, sometimes kind of watching, but, you know, copying from a photograph. And I did it pretty much every page of the book. And these are sort of samples. Let's see. Okay. This one's a little more complicated and loosely related to a book, but let me try to explain, I guess. So that was the install shot. This was a show in New York. And that, what do I keep doing? There's a book open, and this is what you see when you approach it. It's a book on Velázquez, and there's these two paintings here that look fairly similar. No, good, you can see that. But basically, Velázquez, well, it's thought that he did two versions of this painting. One is called Kitchen Maid at Emmaus, and the other one is just called Kitchen Maid. And in one, there's, in the top one, in the background, there's a window, and it's supposed to be the scene where, that's set in the Bible, where Christ comes back from the dead and is presenting himself to the two of the apostles, and as soon as they, like, recognize it's him, he vanishes. So, but in the second painting, there is no window. It's just a wall in the background. And I found these two pieces really kind of interesting because of the either it's a window or painting or whatever, and then suddenly the absence into wall. And there was a type of painting in Spain called bodegones, which were at these kind of bars for ruffians, apparently. And it's supposed to sort of be set there, and there was this kind of drop of the, I think, you know, not all paintings had to be, like, Christian, I guess, or the absence of Christianity was kind of, what am I trying to say? Like, when Still Life came about, I think the emphasis of God in all things became more like in the bowls and the table, and as opposed to literal kind of you know, depictions of the Bible. So anyway, this is a drawing I did of from that painting, and in the background I added a different window, basically, of from, let's see, I don't know if you can see it, but there was a drawing next to it that looked like this, or yeah, here. This is crazy. I guess you can't double click. It does something. It jumps to something. Okay, well, this piece, so there was a website called Learning to Love You More that Miranda July and Harold Fletcher ran, and they had assignments that you could just choose to do and freely submit online. And this one, the assignment was draw a still from a movie that made you cry, or the last movie that made you cry. And it had kind of instructions like, you know, go to the scene, push pause, and draw the TV and everything around it. So I did that. That it was the movie Giant, and it's a moment when Elizabeth Taylor is listening to vows and thinking of her old vows. She's listening to vows at a wedding, I think her daughter's wedding, and she's in a fight with Rock Hudson at the time, and so they weren't seeing each other. And he comes out in the background, and she senses him. And so she just turns around, and that's why I cried. But that's the image that I was trying to put in the back of the Velasquez. But and then this one, it's without Rock Hudson in the background, and instead I put the Velasquez in the back. And here they are kind of side by side. And then on that table that you saw was this page that was, it was a drawing from a book called by Guy Davenport called Every Force Evolves a Form. And it was a book that my boyfriend had and or has, and it had these two rings on it, and I kind of thought it was very romantic and kind of beautiful. And it's about kind of I could actually read it, but it's table manners we learn in Claude Levi-Strauss's ungivingly tedious book, The Origin of Table Manners, are one of our subtlest lines separating civility from barbarity, an orderly barrier erected against chaos and a set of gestured signals that began when the first two people to share a brain tapir trusted each other enough to eat together. Ungivingly tedious, the book is laughably mistitled. It is an analysis of several hundred Amazonian and Plains Indian myths, as well as a continuation of the elaborate structuralist theory of culture, which began two volumes back with The Raw and the Cooked, and From Honey to Ashes. Table manners are first mentioned on page 307. We do not see the phrase again until page 427. Not until page 471 do we leave the rainforest and prairie to hear an intense, brilliant, and brief discourse on what all that has gone before has to do with table manners. Obliquity is the structuralist trademark. There is always something to be explained before something else can be explained. We begin with many versions of a myth about a clinging woman, the hunter Monmaneki and his wives, from the Tacuna of South America. We don't know it yet, but the essence of the book is all here in this strange and apparently pointless tale. The hero gets a frog pregnant by pointing his penis at her. They marry, go hunting together, and straightway bump into the fact that they dine on wholly different things. And the hunter's mother has a sharp word for a daughter-in-law who serves cockroaches as a delicacy. Our hero marries. And the line continues, but I'll just read that. Okay. How long has it been? I have no sense of time. Has it been 20 minutes? I could end now. Has it been? Roughly? What?
It's still early.
It's still early? Okay, well this was a piece that was referencing the book Dark Passage by David Goodes, and I don't know if you've seen the movie, but it's a great film set here with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. Very romantic, and it's in black and white. But the book deals with color in a really interesting way, and it sort of has a color for each character. Like the love between the Lauren Bacall character and Humphrey Bogart is sort of a gray violet with yellow, and the colors for the evil character Madge is orange. And so, and there's also this interesting metaphor of this expanding grid in the book that is supposed to kind of be the feelings of the Humphrey Bogart character, kind of, it's growing and it's numbing and it's kind of a loss of feeling, and it's kind of a poetic book oddly. It's the same writer who wrote Shoot the Piano Player. But what I did is just made a grid of all the colors as they're mentioned in the book, and then wrote the word of the object it's referencing on the color. So you can see, like, all the orange is pretty much the evil, but it ends with a lot of evil. There's the big ball of nothing is the black there. Black is often Fats Waller records, the record player. And then, well, nearby that was this a video, which I'm not going to show because it seemed kind of too complicated, but you could look into these pieces of cardboard through these two holes at the top and see this video I made of my godson actually swinging at a sun pinata that we made for his birthday. And let's see. So, different kind of dark passage, I guess. This piece was from a image from an iPhone that my boyfriend sent to me. He just sent it. He was in Los Angeles, and he saw a Bastian Otter show. And knowing that I love this artist, Bastian Otter, so much, he took it and sent it to me. But Bastian Otter was this Dutch artist who lived in Irvine for a long time, and he had a piece called I'm Searchin', referencing the Coasters song Searchin'. And basically it starts with him just walking along a freeway, and a cameraman's just following him, taking pictures, and he ends up at the coast, and that's kind of the end of it. It's really simple and elegant and beautiful. And it may have been part of a triptych of his, which was called In Search of the Miraculous, which also involved him going on a one-man journey from, I think, Rhode Island or something. And he was supposed to end up in Ireland for a show, but they never found his boat. Or they found his boat, but he wasn't on it. I have this quote here that I wanted to read. Also by Guy Davenport. Or actually, I'll just try to paraphrase it. Guy Davenport has this idea of, I mean, it's a simple idea, but just, you know, that when we're referencing other materials, like James Joyce referencing the Odyssey and writing Ulysses, where, you know, it's an old story and we come back to it again and again. And what we're doing is sort of finishing another person's work. And I really love that idea of finishing. But he goes on to say it's also like finishing, like polishing, like we're polishing somebody's work. And that's kind of how I think of this work, like the way it's referencing other things, like the Coasters, the band, and then Bastian Otter. But also like these layers of kind of how things come to us and through new technologies and whatnot. And I think a lot of my work, because it's sort of based on looking for found images or finding things online, it's this kind of constant, you know, search for something. But I found this really great quote by Felix Gonzalez Torres in an interview, and it sort of challenges that idea a little bit, and so I'm just going to read that. And I think I it got cut off, but somehow he's talking about Althusser, who I don't know much about, Marxist theorist, but he says, Althusser, because what I think he started pointing out were the contradictions within our critique of capitalism. For people who have been reading too much hardcore Marxist theater, it is hard to deal with the fact that they're not saints. And I say, no, they're not. Everything is full of contradictions. There are only different degrees of contradiction. We try to get close to them, but that's it. They are always going to be there. The only thing to do is to give up and pull the plug, but we can't. That's the great thing about Althusser. When you read his philosophy, something that I tell my students is to read once. Read it once. Then if you have problems with it, read it a second time. Then if you still have problems, get drunk and read it a third time with a glass of wine next to you, and you might get something out of it. But always think about practice. The theory in the books is to make you live better, and that's what I think all theory should do. It's about trying to show you certain ways of constructing reality. I'm not even saying finding, and so by finding I'm saying searching, but I'm using my words very carefully, he says. But there are certain ways of constructing reality that helps you live better. There's no doubt about it. When I teach, that's what I show my students, to read all this stuff without a critical attitude. Theory is not the end point of work. It is work along the way to the work. To read it actively is just a process that will hopefully bring us to a less shadowed place. And these last pieces are just from a book called Faceless Book. It's men seeking men on Craigslist. And so these are their own kind of compositions without faces and whatever. And I brought a copy, and I brought actually a lot of hands-on material if anyone wants to look through it. I'll probably spread it out back there. And I think that's it. Thank you so much.